Just wanted to see the sunset. Aaron said goodnight and moved on down the beach toward the lifeguard tower, where he was posted until dark. Ballard watched the sun sink into the black water and then got up. She once again bought takeout for herself and Lola on the boardwalk and ate sitting on a nearby beach. She could not generate much enthusiasm for food and ended up giving half her order of black beans, yellow rice, and plantains to a homeless man she knew named Nate. He was a street artist who, until January, had done decent business selling portraits of the former president. He reported to Ballard that images of the new president went unsold because his kind of people didn't come to Venice Beach. She returned Lola to Sarah's house with more apologies to both dog and sitter, and then headed east back into the city and the cases. She got to Hollywood Station 3 hours before her shift was scheduled to start. In the locker room, after changing into her suit, she pulled a black elastic mourning band from behind her badge and stretched it across the front of the shield. Once she was in the detective bureau, she set up in her usual spot and went right to work on the computer, starting with opening the Los Angeles Times website. She knew she could use the department's own data network. Most investigations resulted in basic information being put online for internal access, but that would leave a signature trail. She wanted the names of the three men murdered in the booth at the Dancers, and believed the city's main media standard-bearer would have acquired them by now, nearly 48 hours since the massacre. She was correct, and quickly found a story that credited the medical examiner's office with releasing the names of the dead after the next of kin notifications and autopsies had been completed. The story identified Cynthia Haddle and Marcus Wilbanks as the Dancers' employees killed by the unknown gunman, and Cordell Abbott, Gordon Fabian, and Gino Santangelo as the three customers who were murdered in the booth where they sat. Names in hand, Ballard proceeded to background the three men in the booth by signing into the crime index and DMV computers. This, too, would leave a trail of her searches, but these would not be as easily detected as her simply using her department access to open the online files of the case. Going that way would leave a flag, immediately alerting the case investigators of her activities. She went through the three names one by one and built data profiles of each. As had been reported the night before on the television news, all three men had criminal records. What raised Ballard's intrigue level was that they appeared to come from different parts of the criminal underworld, and that made their meeting in the booth unusual. Cordell Abbott was a 39-year-old black man who had four convictions on his record for gambling offenses. In each of these cases, he was accused of banking illegal games. In layman's terms, he was a bookie. He took bets on sports, ranging from horse races to Dodgers games. It appeared that despite four convictions, he had never served time in a state prison. At most, his crimes cost him county jail time measured in weeks and months, not years. Similarly, Gordon Fabian had escaped prison time, despite a long history of convictions for various drug-related crimes. Fabian was white, and at 52 years old, the oldest victim of the massacre. Ballard counted 19 arrests on his record dating back to the 1980s. These all related to the personal use or small-time sale of drugs. He received probation and time-served sentences in most cases. In some others, charges were dropped. However, at the time of his murder, Fabian had finally made it to the big leagues and was waiting an upcoming trial in federal court for possession of a kilo of cocaine. He was out on bail but facing a long prison sentence if convicted. The third victim, Gina Santangelo, was a 43-year-old white man and the only one of the three with a record of violence. He had been charged with assault three times over a 15-year period. One case involved a firearm in which he shot but did not kill the victim, and the other two times the charges included a GBI, great bodily injury, add-on by the DA's office. In each of the cases, Santangelo pleaded guilty to lesser charges and received lesser penalties. His first conviction involved the use of the firearm, and that cost him 3 years in a state prison. After that, he apparently got smart and dropped the use of a gun from his repertoire because it would add years to the penalty spectrum. In subsequent arrests, he used his hands and feet to assault the victims and was allowed to plead out to lesser charges, like battery and disturbing the peace, leading to sentences of under a year in the county jail. Ballard's read on Santangelo, without having the details of each case in front of her, was that he was an enforcer for the mob. She keyed on the third case in which he was charged with assault with GBI. It was pleaded down to misdemeanor battery. For a case to drop like that, Ballard knew there had to be a witness or victim issue. Santangelo had a history of violence, but the victim, or maybe a witness, was afraid or refused to testify. The result was a 30-day sentence reduced to a week in the county jail. There was much Ballard could deduce by reading between the lines of the case extracts, but she did not have access to detailed case summaries that put the crimes and the individuals in context. For that, she would need to pull actual files, and that wasn't going to happen on a Saturday night. She did look at booking photos of the three men, which allowed her to recall their positions in the booth where they were murdered. Cordell Abbott was easy to place because he was the only black victim. Ballard remembered seeing his body to the immediate left of the open space in the booth. That put Abbott right next to the shooter. Gordon Fabian's side-view mugshot showed a man with a gray ponytail, and that easily put him in the seat across from the shooter. He was the victim who had fallen halfway out of the booth, the end of his ponytail dipping into his own blood like a paintbrush. And that put Gino Santangelo in the middle. Ballard leaned back in her desk chair and thought about what she knew and what she could assume. Four men slide into a booth. Did they just randomly take their positions, or was there a choreography based on the relationships between the men? There was a bookie, an enforcer, a drug dealer, and for lack of better information, a shooter. Added to this was the question about the shooting sequence. Ballard did not have access to the crime and property reports. But if she had to name one person in the booth besides the shooter who was armed, she would go with Santangelo. He had previously been convicted of a gun crime, and even though he appeared to shrug off the use of firearms and his strong-arm tactics, it was unlikely that he would stop carrying. His record showed him to be a career criminal, and the gun would be one of the tools of the trade. This led to the next question. The split-second selfie video provided by the witness, Alexander Spates, clearly showed the shooter firing first on Fabian, the drug dealer. Why would he do that if he had knowledge of who Santangelo was and that he was most likely armed? Ballard drew several conclusions from her admittedly incomplete information. The first was that the men in the booth didn't all know each other. It was likely that the shooter knew Abbott, the bookie, if he knew any of the men, because he sat next to him. And she figured he fired first on the drug dealer because of malice or momentum. Malice if he held the drug dealer accountable for whatever went wrong during the meeting. Momentum if he simply chose to shoot the other men in a 1-2-3 pattern. It would have been the fastest and safest way to shoot, provided he didn't know that Santangelo was armed. Ballard knew her assumptions got her nowhere. There were myriad other possibilities and factors at work. The shooter might have checked the others for weapons before joining the meeting, and the seating arrangement could have been dictated simply by the separate arrivals of the men. There is no way of knowing anything for sure, and her final conclusion was that she was just spinning her wheels on a case that was not hers, and that she had been clearly ordered to stay away from. But still, she couldn't drop it. It pulled at her because of Chastain, and she now considered a move that would surely get her fired if discovered by the department. Ballard and Chastain had been partners for nearly 5 years before the falling out over her complaint about Olivas. During that time, they worked closely on high-priority and often dangerous investigations. It drew them close, and in many ways, their partnership was like a marriage, although there was never any crossing or even blurring of the professional line. But still, they shared all things work-related, and Ballard even knew Chastain's password into the department's computer system. She had sat next to him too many times while he logged in not to notice and remember it. It was true that the department required detectives to change their passwords every month, but investigators were creatures of habit, and most simply updated the last three digits of a steady password, using the month and year. She believed it was unlikely that he had switched his main password after the dissolution of their partnership. Ballard had not changed her own, because it was easy to remember. Her father's name spelled backward, and she didn't want to be bothered memorizing a combination of letters and numbers that might have no significance to her. She knew that Chastain's password was the date of his marriage, followed by his and his wife's initials and the current month and year. Ballard doubted Chastain's account would already have been deleted following his death. In a bureaucracy like the LAPD, it might take months before the digital access unit wiped the system of his user access. But she knew that if she logged in as Chastain now, the breach could be traced back to the exact computer used. It didn't matter that it wasn't technically Ballard's computer or desk. She would become the primary suspect, and it would result in her dismissal from the force, if not criminal prosecution for hacking. She logged her own user account off the computer and pulled up the entry prompt. She drummed her fingers on the desk for a few moments, waiting for an inner voice to caution her against taking the next step. But it never came. She typed in Chastain's username and password, then waited. She was in. She was now able to follow her old partner's ghost in the system, and she quickly used his approved access to open files on the dancer's case. She opened numerous crime scene and evidence reports, as well as witness summaries and the chronological logs kept by the investigators on the case. Ballard scanned the reports to identify what they were and then sent them to the detective's bureau printer for a more thorough review later. She felt like she had broken into someone's house and needed to get out before being discovered. 15 minutes later, she logged out and was clear. She went to the printer room and pulled out a sheaf of copies nearly 2 inches thick. For the next hour, she took her time and reviewed the documents. Most of it was routine paperwork, but some of the reports offered a fuller glimpse of the crime and the parts individuals played. Most notable were the fuller background reports on the three victims in the booth. The bio on Santangelo stated that he was a known loan shark and debt collector, connected with an organized crime family based in Las Vegas. Additionally, the crime scene report noted that a .45 caliber handgun was indeed found tucked into the waistband of his suit pants. The gun was traced back to a 2013 home burglary in Summerland, Nevada. One document that was surprising for its lack of content was the video survey report. It stated that a review of footage from cameras at the entrance of the dancers, as well as from nearby businesses on Sunset Boulevard and the vicinity, revealed no images of a suspected shooter or his vehicle. The video unit could not provide even the barest minimum description of a getaway vehicle or direction of travel, east or west, the killer had taken. To Ballard, it was almost as if the shooter knew there were no cameras or had chosen the location of the meeting based on the video cracks he could slip through. Disappointed, Ballard moved on and finished with the investigative chronologies. There were 5 detectives assigned full-time to the case, plus Lieutenant Olivas. This produced 3 chronos from the 2 pairs of detectives and Chastain, the task force whip. There was no chronological report yet from Olivas. From these documents, Ballard was able to see the moves being made and discern that the primary focus of the investigation was Santangelo. It was believed that the mass killing might have been a hit on a mob figure, with the 4 other victims being collateral damage. One of the detective teams had been dispatched to Las Vegas to pursue this angle. Ballard knew that all of this would likely change with the murder of Chastain. Investigative priorities would be recalibrated. If the detective's murder and the dancer's massacre were linked forensically or by other evidence, then it would obviously mean the killer was still in Los Angeles. Ballard read through Chastain's chrono last. She saw that he had dutifully logged his visit to the Hollywood division to consult with her and to pick up the witness, Alexander Spates. It also showed that he later identified Metro, the friend and co-worker Spates had been with at the club, as Matthew Robison, 25, who lived on La Jolla Avenue in West Hollywood. Chastain interviewed Robison Friday morning at his apartment after getting the information from the manager of the Slick Kicks store. A note in the chrono after the entry said DSS, which Ballard remembered was Chastain's shorthand for a witness who supposedly didn't see shit. Neither Spates nor Robison was a probative witness, but the split-second video that Spates came up with was still of high value. If charges and a trial ever emerged out of the investigation, Spates would be a witness, if only to introduce the selfie in which he had captured the first shot. If he was challenged in some way by the defense, his pal Robison could be brought in to testify and back up his story. Chastain's chrono contained 2 phone call entries that intrigued Ballard. The first was at 1:10 p.m. Friday. It was an outgoing call that Chastain had placed to someone named Dean Towson, and the second was the last entry in the chrono, an incoming call at 5:10 p.m. from Matthew Robison, the witness who supposedly hadn't seen shit. No further explanation of either of the calls was registered in the log. Chastain had probably intended to fill out the details later, but Ballard noted that the call had come in and Chastain had logged it shortly before he got the word from Olivas that he was off duty for the evening. The name Dean Towson was familiar to Ballard, but she couldn't place it. She Googled it on the computer and soon was looking at the website for a criminal defense attorney specializing in federal court cases. Fabian, Ballard said out loud. It clicked. Fabian was facing federal drug charges. Towson specialized in federal cases. It was likely that he was Fabian's attorney on the Kelo case and that Chastain had reached out to him to see if he might know why his client was in that booth at the dancers when the shooting started. Ballard checked the clock over the TV screens and saw it was almost 10. She knew she could run Towson's home address down through the DMV and go knock on his door, but it was late on a Saturday and she decided her approach to the lawyer would probably be better received in daylight hours. She put the idea aside and instead called the phone number Robeson had called Chastain from. The chrono listed it as a 213 area code. Her call went unanswered and direct to a beep without an outgoing greeting. She left a message. "Mr. Robeson, this is Detective Ballard with the LAPD. I'm following up on a phone conversation you had Friday with Detective Chastain. Could you give me a call back as soon as possible?" She was leaving her number on the message when she saw on one of the TV screens video footage from outside Ken Chastain's house. The media had finally been alerted to the story. The sound was down on the screen, but on the video, Ballard saw the chief of police addressing several reporters while Oliva stood just behind him to his left. The chief looked ashen, as though he knew that whatever had started in that booth at the dancers had now reached deep into his department and done irreparable damage. Ballard didn't need to hear a statement to know that. The last set of documents Ballard looked through were Chastain's own rough notes on the autopsies. He had transferred them to a digital file in preparation for writing reports to be submitted to the overall case file. He was dead before he got the chance to accomplish that. Because the case was of highest priority, high enough to draw Dr. J, the coroner herself, out to the crime scene, the examinations of the bodies were conducted late Friday morning at the medical examiner's office, with Dr. J supervising several deputy coroners assigned to each of the bodies. While there was little doubt as to cause of death of the victims, recovery of bullets from the bodies was an important step in the investigation and thus gave the individual cases priority status. Usually autopsies weren't even scheduled for 24 to 48 hours. These were conducted less than 12 hours after the deaths. Dr. J conducted the Fabian autopsy herself. The actual autopsy report would take several days to produce, but in the meantime, Chastain took notes as the attending investigator. It was in those notes that Ballard came across a sentence and a question that turned her thoughts on the case in a new direction. According to Chastain's notes, Dr. J had labeled a wound on Fabian's chest as a first-degree burn that had occurred at the time of death, but was not caused by a firearm. Chastain had added a second notation to this conclusion. Battery burn? Ballard froze as she remembered seeing Chastain, Dr. J, and Lieutenant Lelivas gathered around Fabian's body at the crime scene and studying his chest. Now she knew why. Fabian had a burn on his chest that may have come from a battery. Ballard quickly moved back to the property report on Fabian and saw nothing listed as recovered with a body that could explain the burn. Whatever was burning him at the time of the shooting was taken from the scene, apparently by the shooter. It all tumbled together for Ballard. She believed that Fabian was wearing a listening device. He was wired at the dancers' meeting, and the battery of the device had started to burn him. It was a well-known hazard in undercover work. Compact listening devices overheat, and oils and sweat from the body can create an arcing connection with the battery. Professional UCs take measures to insulate themselves from what they call bug burn, wrapping the devices in rubber sheathing to place the devices away from the body's sweat glands. There was nothing in the background material in Fabian that Ballard had reviewed that showed he had ever worked as an undercover operative. But there was a burn on his chest that indicated otherwise in the dancer's massacre. Ballard believed that Chastain was onto something, and it might have been what got him killed. Chapter 18. Ballard waited until 9 a.m. Sunday to knock on Dean Towson's door. She had just come from breakfast at the Dupars in Studio City after a relatively slow night on the late shift. She'd had only two call-outs, first to sign off on a suicide and a second to aid in the search for a missing old man with Alzheimer's. He was found in the neighbor's carport before she even got to the call location. It had taken all of her will and patience to hold back from attempting to make contact with Towson in the middle of the night. The more she considered Ken Chastain's autopsy notes, the more she believed that Towson might hold a key to solving the mystery of what happened in the booth at the dancers. But she managed to exercise restraint and used the time between the callouts to take a deeper dive into all law enforcement databases available in a search for details about the three men murdered in the booth at the dancers. The effort paid off just before dawn. By collating the criminal histories of the three men along with their incarceration locations, she was able to find the crossing point, the place where all three of them could have previously met and interacted. 5 years earlier, all three men from the booth were housed at the Peter J. Pitchess Detention Center in Castaic. Pitchess was part of Los Angeles County's vast jail system. Decades earlier, it was a minimum security drunk farm, where hapless miscreants dried out and served their sentences for drunk driving and public intoxication. Now it was the biggest facility in the county system and operated under heavy security. Almost 8,000 male inmates were housed there while awaiting trial or serving sentences of less than a year. In May 2012, Santangelo was in Pitchess in the middle of a 90-day sentence for battery while Fabian was there for a 30-day stint for a drug possession rap, and Abbott was finishing a 6-month term for an illegal gaming conviction. As far as Ballard could determine, the three men had overlapped in Pitchess for 3 weeks. Ballard knew Pitchess was a big place. She had been there numerous times to conduct interviews with inmates. But she knew there were always ways of cutting down the population pool that would have included the three men from the booth. Gangs were segregated according to race and affiliation, and the dorms dedicated to gangs at Pitchess accounted for half of the facility's capacity. Ballard had found no record of any of the three booth men having street gang affiliation. The remaining half of the facility was further segregated into dorms for inmates awaiting trials and hearings, and for those already convicted and serving out sentences. Santangelo, Fabian, and Abbott were in this latter group. They were already sentenced. That put the pool that they were swimming in at approximately 2,000 inmates. It was a small enough number that Ballard believed it was possible that the three men interacted. All three men were involved in crimes of vice, gambling, loan sharking, and drugs, and they may have engaged in their businesses even behind the steel fences of the jail. The bottom line was that Ballard had good reason to believe that Santangelo, Fabian, and Abbott had known each other for as long as 5 years before their fateful and final meeting at the dancers. There was nothing in the case reports Ballard had reviewed to indicate that the official investigation of the dancers' massacre had reached the same conclusion about the victims in the booth. Ballard now faced the dilemma of whether she should find a way to share her information with the investigation, even though it was headed by the man who had done his level best to drive her from the police department. Additionally, her conclusions about the three men could reflect on the fourth unknown man in the booth, the shooter. Had he also been at Pitchess with the other three? Was he also a trafficker in vice operations? Or was he someone whose connection to the other men came from a completely different angle? As she checked out at the end of the shift and headed for breakfast, Ballard decided she would continue her investigation and would find a conduit for feeding her findings to the official inquiry. She somehow felt she owed that to Chastain. Fed in full, she now wanted to brace Towson before he could leave home for the day. 8 o'clock would have been her preferred time, but she gave him an extra hour of sleep because it was a Sunday. She was counting on his cooperation, and that extra hour of sleep could pay off. She also had hoped to catch him before he'd had time to read the Times, because she knew there was a story in it about Chastain's murder. If Towson was aware of the murder, he might refuse to talk to her out of fear that whoever had targeted Chastain might go after him next. Ballard knew that all of Chastain's moves over the last 2 days would be retraced by the detectives investigating his murder. The Times story, which he had read at Dupar's, said that the murder was being folded into the dancers' investigation, but the team working on the case would be bolstered by the detectives from the Major Crimes Unit. Ballard had pulled Towson's home address off the DMV computer and proceeded to Sherman Oaks after breakfast, carrying with her 2 cups of coffee and a cardboard tray. The defense lawyer lived in a townhouse on Dickens, just a block south of Ventura Boulevard. The place had underground parking and a security entrance on the street. Ballard waited on the sidewalk and went in when someone stepped through the gate to walk a dog. "Forgot my keys," she mumbled. She located Towson's door and knocked. She pulled her badge off her belt and had it up and ready. He answered the door in what she assumed were his sleep clothes, workout pants and a t-shirt with a Nike swoosh on it. He was about 50 in short with a pot belly, glasses, and a gray beard. "Mr. Towson, LAPD, I need to ask you a few questions. How'd you get into the building?" "The security door was ajar. I just came in." "It has a spring. It should have automatically closed. Anyway, I already talked to the LAPD, and it's a Sunday morning. Can't this wait until tomorrow? I have no court. I'll be in the office all day." No, sir. It can't wait. As you know, we have a critical investigation underway, and we're cross-matching our interviews. What the hell is cross-matching? Different detectives covering the same ground. Sometimes one picks up something the other missed. Witnesses remember new details. I'm not a witness to anything, but you have information that is important. You know what cross-matching sounds like? It sounds like what you do when you don't have jack shit. Thaler didn't respond. She wanted him to think that. It would make him feel important and he would be more open. It seemed clear that he didn't know that Chastain was dead. She proffered the cardboard tray. I brought you a coffee, she said. That's okay, he said. I brew my own. He stepped back so she could enter. She was in. Towson offered Ballard a seat in the kitchen so they could talk while he brewed. Ballard drank her Dupar's coffee. She had been running for almost 24 hours straight and needed it. Do you live alone here? She asked. Yep, he said. I'm as single as they come. You? It was an odd question to throw back at her. She had been establishing the lay of the land, who was in the house and how she might conduct the interview. His question to her wasn't an appropriate response, but she saw in it the opportunity to foster cooperation and to get what she needed from him. Nothing serious, she said. I work odd hours and it's hard to keep anything going. There, she had shown him the possibility. It was now time to get down to business. You were handling Gordon Fabian's defense in the federal drug case, she said. That's right, Towson said. And I know it sounds cynical, but his getting killed saved my having to put a goose egg on my scorecard, if you know what I mean.
You mean you were going to lose the case?
That's right. He was going to go down.
Did Fabian know it?
I told him. They caught him fair and square with a kilo in the glove compartment of the car he was driving, was alone in, and that was registered to him. There was really no way out of that box. Their probable cause to stop him was down the line legit as well. I had nothing to work with. We were going to trial, and it was going to be a very quick ride to a guilty verdict.
He wasn't interested in a plea agreement?
None was offered. The kilo had cartel markings on it. The prosecutor would only talk about a plea if Fabian gave up his connection. And Fabian wasn't going to do that, because he said he'd rather go to prison for 5 years, that's the mandatory minimum, than have the Sinaloa cartel put a hit on him for flipping. He was out on bail, 100K. How'd he come up with money for that and money for you? You are one of the better, more expensive attorneys in town. If there is a compliment in there, thank you. Fabian liquidated his mother's home, as well as some other valuables. It was enough to cover my fee and the 10% bond. Ballard nodded and took a long drink of tepid coffee. She saw Towson surreptitiously check his reflection in the glass of the overhead cabinet door and smooth his hair. She had him saying more than he should about the case. Maybe it was because the client was dead and didn't matter. Maybe it was because he was interested in her, and he knew the best way to a detective's heart was through cooperation. She knew that she now had to get to the purpose of her visit. My colleague, Detective Chastain, called you Friday, she said.
That's right, Towson said, and I told him pretty much what I'm telling you. I know nothing about what happened.
You don't have any idea why Fabian was at the dancers on Thursday night?
Not really. All I know is that he was a desperate man. They do desperate things.
Like what?
Like I don't know.
Had he ever mentioned the names Cordell Abbott or Gino Santangelo to you before?
We are straying into areas of attorney-client privilege which happens to stay solidly in place after death. But I'll tell you this. The answer is no. He never mentioned them to me. Though it is obvious he knew them. He was, after all, murdered with them.
Ballard decided to get to the point. Towson was either willing to cross the privilege line or he was not.
Why was Fabian wearing a wire to that meeting at the dancers? She asked.
Towson stared at her for a moment before answering. Ballard could tell the question had struck a chord. It meant something.
That's interesting, Towson said.
Really? Ballard said. Why is it interesting?
Because, as we have already established, he was fucked. And at some point in our relationship, I told him that if he wasn't willing to give up the cartel, his only way out might be to give up somebody else.
And how did he respond to that?
Towson breathed out heavily. You know what? I think I need to wave the attorney-client confidentiality flag here. We are getting too far into private communications between...
Please. Six people are dead. If you know something, I need to know it.
I thought it was 5.
Ballard realized that she had slipped and included Chastain in the count.
I mean five. What did Fabian say when you asked if he could give somebody else up?
Towson finally began to pour himself a cup of coffee. Ballard watched and waited.
Do you know that I worked for the district attorney's office as a baby lawyer? He asked.
No, I didn't know that, Ballard said.
Ballard silently rebuked herself for not backgrounding Towson when she was backgrounding his client.
Towson got a half-gallon container of skim milk out of the refrigerator and topped off his cup.
Yes, I was 8 years there as a deputy DA, he said. The last four, I was in JCID. You know what that is, right?
Everybody called it that, and everybody knew what it meant.
The Justice System Integrity Division was the DA's own watchdog unit.
You investigated cops, Ballard said.
Towson nodded, then leaned back against the counter and stayed standing as he sipped from the cup. Ballard thought it was some kind of male thing. Stay standing and you have the higher ground in the conversation.
That's right, he said.
And we ran a lot of wires, you know. Best way to bring a dirty cop to ground was to get them on tape. They always folded if they knew their own words were going to be played in open court. Their own guilty words.
He paused there, and Ballard said nothing. She knew he was trying to give her something, and still not tread all the way across the line of his dead client's confidentiality. She waited, and Towson took another drink of coffee before continuing.
So let me preface this by saying again that I do not know why Fabian was in that club Thursday night, and that I have no idea who he was meeting with or what it was about. But I explained to him that if he was going to give somebody up in exchange for a plea agreement, it had to be a bigger fish than himself. I mean, obviously that's how it works. He had to give up somebody the U.S. Attorney's Office would want more than it wanted him.
Okay. And what did he say to that?
He said, how about a cop?
Towson made a gesture with his cup of coffee of sweeping his arm away from his body, like he was saying, you can take the story from there.
Ballard composed herself and her thoughts. What Towson was saying matched the theory she had been considering through the night, that Fabian had worn a wire to the meeting at the dancers, and that the fourth man in the booth was a police officer. It was the only explanation for Chastain's behavior, his continuing to work the case Friday night after being told to go home.
Let's back up a second, she said.
When was your conversation about bigger fish with Fabian?
About a month ago, Towson said. It was the last time I spoke to him.
And what did you say when he said, how about a cop?
I said I knew from my JCID days that the feds always like to trade for cops.
Sorry, but that's a fact. More headlines, more political cachet. Single-key drug dealers are a dime a dozen. Prosecuting a cop gets a DA salivating.
So you told him all that.
Did you tell him to wear a wire?
No, I never said that.
I cautioned him.
I said crooked cops are very dangerous because they have so much to lose.
Did you ask who the cop was?
No, I didn't.
You have to understand that this was a very general conversation. It was not a planning meeting. He didn't say, I know a bent cop. He said, what if I could deliver a cop? And in very general terms, I said, yeah, a cop would be good. And that was it. I didn't tell him to wear a wire, but I may have said something along the lines of making sure that he had something solid. That was it, and that was the last time we spoke. I never saw him again.
Ballard now believed she knew the motive for the massacre, and the reason the shooter took out Fabian first. Because he was the traitor.
The shooter eliminated everyone in the booth, then reached into Fabian's shirt and pulled the recorder.
The question was, how did the shooter know about the wire?
To Ballard, it seemed obvious. The recorder had started to burn Fabian's chest, and he either revealed himself by flinching or attempting to pull the wire off his skin. There was some kind of tell that the cop in the booth picked up on, and he acted quickly and decisively when he realized the meeting was a setup.
Ballard looked at Towson and wondered how much she could reveal now.
Did Detective Chastain ask you any questions along these lines Friday?
No, he didn't. He never mentioned any of this.
Good.
Good? Why is that good?
Did you watch or read the news last night or this morning, Mr. Towson?
I just got up. I haven't seen anything.
There actually are six victims now. Detective Chastain was murdered late Friday night.
Towson's eyes widened as he computed the news and went straight to Ballard's intended conclusion.
Am I in danger? He asked.
I don't know, Ballard said. But you should take all possible precautions.
Are you kidding me? I wish I was. Don't put me in the middle of this thing. I made a suggestion to a client. That's it.
I understand that. And as far as I'm concerned, this conversation was private. It won't go into any report or record. I promise you that.
Jesus Christ, you should have told me that Chastain got clipped.
I did.
Yeah, after you got what you wanted from me.
5 minutes later, after assuring Towson she would not put him in harm's way, Ballard was putting on sunglasses as she was headed back to her van. At its door, she pretended to fumble with her keys, as she surreptitiously checked her surroundings. She had spooked Towson, and in doing so had spooked herself. It was time for her to follow her own advice and take all possible precautions.
Chapter 19.
Ballard needed to sleep, but she kept pushing herself. After leaving Towson, she drove back over the hill and drove into West Hollywood. Her next stop was Matthew Metro Robison's home. She had left 3 messages through the night for him, and he had not returned the calls. Robison's DMV address led Ballard to an apartment complex on La Jolla, south of Santa Monica. As she cruised by, she saw an obvious city ride parked at the curb out front. She kept going and pulled over a half block away. Stedman had told Ballard that Chastain texted his wife about wrangling a witness. Identifying and finding that witness would be priority one. And since Chastain had documented a call from Robison as the last investigative move on his chrono, it looked like the shoe salesman was of high interest to the task force. Ballard adjusted her side-view mirror so she could keep an eye on the city ride. After 20 minutes, she saw 2 detectives leave Robison's building and get in. She identified them as Corey Stedman and his partner Jerry Rudolph. They did not have anyone with them, which meant either Robison had not been home or he was home and had answered questions to their satisfaction. Judging by the lack of response from Robison the night before, Ballard was thinking that the most likely scenario was that he had not been there. Ballard waited until Stedman and Rudolph drove off before she got out of her car and walked back to the apartment building. There was no security gate. She got to Robison's door and was surprised when her knock was answered. A small woman, who looked like she was about 19, peered out at her from behind a security chain. Ballard showed her badge.
"Are you Metro's girlfriend?" she asked.
She was hoping her gender and seeming familiarity would get her further than the 2 white male detectives who had just been there.
"What about it?" the woman said.
"Like those 2 men who were just here? I'm looking for them," Ballard said. "But for different reasons."
"What's your reason?"
"I'm worried about him. He reached out to my partner on Friday, and now my partner's dead. I don't want Metro to get hurt."
"You know Metro?"
"Not really. I was just trying to keep him and his friend Xander out of this as much as I could."
"Do you know where he is?"
The girl tightened her lips and Ballard saw her holding back tears.
"No,"
she said in a strangled voice.
"When was the last time he was home?" Ballard asked.
"Friday. I had work, and when I got off at 10, he wasn't here, and he didn't answer his texts. He's gone, and I've been waiting."
"Was he supposed to work at Kix yesterday?"
"Yes, and he didn't show. I went there and I talked to Xander and he said he never came in. They said that he's fired if he doesn't show up today. I'm freaking out."
"My name is Renee," Ballard asked. "What's yours?"
"Alicia," the girl said.
"Did you tell all of this to those 2 detectives who were just here, Alicia?"
"No, they scared me. I just said he wasn't here. They came last night too and asked the same questions."
"Okay, let's go back to Friday. Metro called my partner at about 5 o'clock.
Were you with him then?"
"No, I go in at 4.
"And where is that?"
"Starbucks in Santa Monica."
"Where was Metro when you last saw him?"
"Here. He was off Friday and he was here when I left for work."
"What was he doing?"
"Nothing, just watching TV on the couch."
She turned away from the door opening as if to check the couch in the room behind her. She then turned back to Ballard.
"What should I do?"
she asked, a tone of desperation clearly in her voice.
"You're in West Hollywood here," Ballard said.
"Have you reported him missing to the sheriff's department?"
"No, not yet."
"Then I think what you should do is report him missing. It's been 2 nights and he hasn't come home, and he hasn't reported for work. Call the West Hollywood substation and make the report."
"They won't do anything."
"They will do what they can, Alicia. But if Metro is hiding because he's scared, that will make it hard to find him."
"But if he is hiding, why doesn't he text me?"
Ballard had no answer for that,
and was afraid her face revealed her true theory about Metro's fate.
"I'm not sure," she said. "Maybe he will. Maybe he's keeping his phone off because he's afraid people can track him through it."
That provided no comfort.
"I have to go," Alicia said.
Slowly, she closed the door. Ballard reached out her hand and stopped it.
"Let me give you my card," she said.
"If you hear from Metro, tell him the safest thing for him to do is call me. Tell him Detective Chastain and I used to be partners, and he trusted me." She pulled out a business card and passed it through the opening. Alicia took it without a word and then closed the door. Ballard got back into the car and folded her arms onto the steering wheel. She leaned her forehead down against them and closed her eyes. She was beyond tired, but her mind couldn't let go of the case. Matthew Robison had at first been a witness classified as DSS. Didn't see shit. And then at 5:10 p.m. Friday, he called Chastain. Within hours, one would be dead and one would be missing. What had happened? What did Metro know? Ballard startled as her phone rang. She pulled her head up and checked the screen. It was her grandmother.
"Tutu?
Hello, Renee. Is everything okay, Tutu?"
"Everything is fine, but a man was here. He said he was police and he was looking for you. I thought you should know."
"Sure. Did he tell you his name and show you a badge?"
She tried to keep the urgency and concern out of her voice. Her grandmother was 82 years old.
"He had a badge and he gave me a business card. He said you have to call him."
"Okay, I will. Can you read me his name and give me the number?"
"Yes, it's Rogers, with the S at the end. Carr, spelled with two R's."
"Rogers Carr. What about a number so I can call him?"
Ballard grabbed a pen out of the center console and wrote a 213 number on an old parking receipt. She didn't recognize the name or number.
"Tutu, does it say under his name where he works, like what unit?"
"Yes, it says Major Crimes Unit."
Now Ballard understood what was happening.
"Perfect, Tutu. I'll give him a call. Was he by himself when he came to the door?"
"Yeah, he was by himself. Are you coming up tonight?"
No, I don't think so this week. I'm working a case, Tutu."
"Renee, it's your weekend."
I know, but they've got me working. Maybe I'll get an extra day if we wrap this up.
Have you been out to check the break lately?"
"Every day I walk on the beach. A lot of boys on the water. Must be good."
Ballard's grandmother lived in Ventura, not far from Solimar Beach and Muscle Shoals, the places where her son, Renee's father, had grown up surfing.
"Well," Ballard said, "I hope it's still good next week. I'm going to call this guy now, Tutu, and see what he wants. I'll let you know next week when I'm heading up."
"Okay, Renee, be careful."
"I know, Tutu."
Ballard disconnected and looked at the clock on the screen. It was 11:11, and that meant the stores on Melrose Avenue were open. According to Alicia, Xander Spates wasn't missing. She had spoken to him on Saturday at Kick's when she went in looking for Metro. Ballard started the engine and dropped the car into drive. She headed down La Jolla toward Melrose. Despite what she had said to her grandmother, she had no intention of calling Roger's car. She knew what he was up to and what he wanted. Major crimes had been folded into the Dancer's Chastain investigation, and like Stedman and Rudolph, Carr was most likely involved in tracing Chastain's last steps. That would include his visit to Hollywood Station to pick up Xander Spates and his cell phone. It would also include the final conversation she had with Chastain. That was personal and private, and she didn't want to share it. Ballard listed her grandmother's address as her permanent address on all departmental personnel records. She had a bedroom in the little bungalow and spent most of her days off up there, drawn by Tutu's home cooking and conversation, the nearby surf breaks, and the washer and dryer in the garage. But nobody besides her partner Jenkins knew exactly where she went on days off the job. The fact that Carr had made the 90-minute drive up to the house in Ventura told Ballard that he had gotten access to her personnel jacket, and that bothered her. She decided that if Carr wanted to talk to her, then he could come find her. Kix was like a lot of shops that line Melrose between Fairfax and La Brea, minimalist, chic, and expensive. It was essentially a custom athletic shoe store. Shoes by recognizable brands like Nike, Adidas, and New Balance were modified with dyes, pins, zippers, and sewn-on sequins, crosses, and rosaries, and then sold for hundreds of dollars over the original retail price. And by the looks of things, when Ballard entered, nobody seemed to mind. There was a sign behind the cash register station that said, "The shoe is art." Ballard felt about as with it as a chaperone at a high school dance.
She scanned the already crowded store and saw Spates opening a shoebox for a customer interested in a pair of Nikes with pink lipstick kisses emblazoned on them. He was extolling the cool factor of the shoes when he saw Ballard hovering nearby. "I'll be right with you, detective," he said. He said it loud enough to draw everyone in the store's attention to Ballard. She ignored the stares and picked up a shoe off one of the clear plastic pedestals used to display the store's wares. It was a red Converse high top that had somehow been mounted on a 3-inch platform heel.
"You would look great in those, detective."
Ballard turned. It was Spates. He had broken away from his customer, who was pacing in front of a mirror and considering the Nikes with kisses that she had tried on. "I'm not sure they would hold up on a fast break," she said. His face betrayed that Spates didn't get the joke. Ballard moved on. "Xander, I need to talk to you for a few minutes. Do you have an office in the back where we can have some privacy?" Spates gestured toward his customer. "I'm working, and this is a commission shop," he said. "We have a sale today, and I have to sell. I can't just..." "Okay, I get it," Ballard said. "Just tell me about Metro. Where is he?"
"I don't know where Metro is, man.
He's supposed to be here. He didn't show yesterday either, and when I called him, he didn't pick up." "If he was hiding, where would he go?"
"What? I don't know. I mean, who goes into hiding? This is so weird."
"When was the last time you saw him?"
"That night when we left the club."
"Look, my customer is waiting. Let her look at herself for a couple more minutes."
"What about Friday?"
"You didn't see him Friday?"
"No, we were both off Fridays. That's why we went out Thursday night."
"So you don't know what he was doing Friday? You never called him to tell him about coming to the station and the police taking your phone? You didn't warn him that we might want to talk to him?"
"No, because he didn't see anything that night. Neither of us did. And besides, I couldn't call him, because you and that detective took my phone."
"So why did he call the police on Friday at 5? What did he know?"
"I have no idea why he called or what he knew, and I'm about to lose a sale. I gotta go."
Spates walked away from Ballard and over to his customer, who was now sitting down and taking off the Nikes. It looked to Ballard like a no sale. She realized that she was still holding the Converse with the 3-inch heel. She checked the underside of the shoe and saw a price tag of $395. She then carefully put it back on its pedestal, leaving it there like a work of art. Ballard headed out to Venice and sleep after that. She picked up Lola and pitched her tent 50 yards north of the Rose Avenue lifeguard stand. She was so tired that she decided to sleep first and paddle afterward. Her sleep was repeatedly interrupted by a series of calls to her phone from a 213 number that matched digit for digit the number her grandmother had read off the business card given to her by Roger's car. She didn't answer, and he kept calling, popping her out of sleep every 30 or 40 minutes. He never left a message. After the third interruption, Ballard put the phone on mute. After that, she slept a solid 3 hours, waking with her arm draped around Lola's neck. She checked her phone and saw that Carr had called 2 more times, and finally, after the last call, left a message.
"Detective Ballard, this is Detective Rogers Carr with Major Crimes. Listen, we need to talk. I'm on the team investigating the murder of fellow officer Ken Chastain. Can you call me back so we can set up a face-to-face?"
He left 2 numbers, his cell, which Ballard already had, and his landline at the PAB. Ballard was always annoyed by people who prefaced what they said with the word "listen." "Listen, we need to talk." "Listen, no we don't." She decided not to call him back yet. It was supposedly her day off, and she was losing the light. Through the tent zipper slot, she checked the water and saw that the afternoon wind had kicked up a light chop. She looked up at the sun and estimated she could get in an hour's paddle before dusk, when the sharks came out. 15 minutes later, Ballard was on the water with the passenger. Lola sat on her haunches, wading down the front of the board as it nosed through the chop. Ballard paddled north against the wind, so she could count on it to be at her back when she was spent in returning to the beach. She dug deep into the water with long, smooth strokes. As she worked, she let the details of the dancer's case flow through her mind. She tried to delineate what she knew, what she could assume, and what she didn't know. If she assumed that the fourth man in the booth was a cop, that made it a meeting of individuals with expertise in several areas of vice and law enforcement, gambling, loan sharking, and drugs. Fabian, the drug dealer, had asked his attorney about delivering a cop to trade for his help on the case. That indicated that he knew of a cop who was involved in illegal activities. Perhaps a cop who had taken bribes or had run interference on cases. Perhaps a cop who owed money. Ballard could see a scenario where a cop who owed money to a bookie would be introduced to a loan shark with perhaps the drug dealer as the go-between. Another scenario she paddled through had the cop already owing the bookie and loan shark and being introduced to the drug dealer to set up a deal that would pay off his debts. There were many plausible possibilities, and she could not narrow anything down without more facts. She changed the direction of the board and shifted her focus to Chastain. His actions indicated that he had been on the same path that Ballard was on now, but that he had somehow drawn attention to it, and it had gotten him killed. The question was, how did he get there so fast? He did not have the information Ballard had gotten from Towson, yet something had told him it was a cop who had been in that booth. She went back to the start, to the call-out on the case. She quickly went through her own steps in the investigation, beginning at Hollywood Presbyterian and carrying it through to her dismissal by Olivas at the crime scene. She examined each moment as though it were a film, and she was interested in everything in its frame. Eventually, she saw something that didn't fit. It was the last moment at the crime scene, Olivas in her face, insulting her and telling her to leave. She had looked over his shoulder for a sympathetic eye. First it was to the coroner, and then it was to her old partner. But Dr. J had looked away, and Chastain had been busying himself bagging evidence. He never even looked her way. She now realized that that was the moment. Chastain was bagging something. It had looked like a black button to Ballard, while Olivas had his back turned and was looking at her. Chastain also had his back turned to Dr. J, so she would not have a view of what he was doing either. Detectives didn't bag evidence at crime scenes. The criminalists did. On top of that, it had been too early for anyone to be picking up and bagging evidence. The crime scene was fresh, bodies were still in place, and the 3D crime scene camera had not even been set up. What was Chastain doing? Why was he breaking protocol and removing something from the crime scene before it was properly noted, recorded, and cataloged? Ballard was exhausted, but she picked up her pace, pushing herself harder with each dig of the paddle. Her shoulders, arms, and thighs were vibrating with the strain. She needed to get back. She needed to return to Chastain's case files to figure out what she had missed. As she cut to the shore, she forgot about the pain and her plans when she saw a man waiting next to her tent. He was in jeans and a black bomber jacket and wearing black aviators. She knew he was a cop before she could make out the badge on his belt. Ballard came out of the water and quickly removed the board's leash. She then wrapped the Velcro ankle strap around the ring on Lola's collar. She knew Lola could easily break it if she lunged, but Ballard was hoping she would feel the tug of the strap and know she was under Ballard's control. "Be easy, girl," Ballard said. With the board under her left arm and her fingers in the grip hole, she walked slowly toward the man in the aviators. He looked familiar, but she couldn't place him. Maybe it was just the sunglasses. They were standard with most cops. He spoke before Ballard had to. "Renee Ballard? I've been trying to reach you. Rogers Carr, Major Crimes." "How'd you find me?" "Well, I'm a detective. Some people, believe it or not, say a pretty good one." "Don't joke with me. Tell me how you found me or you can go fuck off." Carr held his hands up in surrender. "Whoa, sorry. I didn't mean to piss anybody off. I put out a broadcast on your van and a couple of bicycle cops saw it in the lot. I came, I asked around, I'm here." Ballard put her board down next to her tent. She heard a low rumbling, like distant thunder coming from Lola's chest. The dog had picked up her vibe. "You put out a broadcast on my van?" she asked. "It's not even registered in my name." "I know that," Carr said. "But I met Julia Ballard today. I believe she is your grandmother. I ran her name for registered vehicles and came up with the van. I heard you like surfing and put two and two together." He gestured toward the ocean, as if it confirmed his investigative logic. "I was paddleboarding," Ballard said. "It's not surfing. What do you want?" "I just want to talk," Carr said. "Did you get my message on your cell?" "Nope." "Well, I left you a message." "I'm off today. My phone's off, too." "I'm on the Chastain case, and we're retracing his moves in the last 48 hours. You had some interaction with him, and I need to ask you about it. That's it. Nothing sinister, strictly routine. But I have to get it done." Ballard reached down and patted Lola on the shoulder, letting her know everything was all right. "There's a place down there on Dudley called The Candle," she said. "It's on the boardwalk. I'll meet you there in 15 minutes. "Why can't we go now?" Carr asked. "Because I need to get a shower and to wash the salt off my dog's legs. 20 minutes, tops." You can trust me, Carr. I'll be there.
Do I have a choice?
Not if this is as routine as you claim it is. Try the mahi-mahi tacos. They're good. Meet you there. Get an outside table. I'm bringing the dog.
Chapter 20.
Carr was dutifully sitting at the table along the outer railing of the restaurant's side porch when Ballard showed up. She hooked the leash to the railing so Lola could be next to their table, but on the sidewalk outside the restaurant. She then walked around to the porch entrance, crossing behind Carr's back, and sat down across from the major crimes detective. She put her phone on the table. As she passed his back, she had turned on the recording app she used for documenting her own interviews. Carr didn't seem to suspect anything. Putting a phone on a table was a routine, though rude, habit with many people. He smiled as Ballard sat down. He looked over the railing at her dog lying on the sidewalk. "Is that a pit bull?" he asked. "Boxer mix," she said. "First things first, Carr. Am I a suspect in any criminal investigation or internal investigation? If so, I want a defense rep." Carr shook his head. "No, not at all," he said. "If you were a suspect, we'd be having this conversation in the box at Pacific Division. It's like I told you. I'm on the Chastain thing, and I'm part of a team retracing his steps in the last 48 hours of his life. So I guess that means you guys don't have shit," she said. "That's a fair assessment. No suspects in the dancer shooting, so no suspects on Chastain. And you're sure they're connected?" "Seem to be. But I don't think we're sure about anything. On top of that, it's not my call. I'm a gopher on this. Yesterday morning, I was booking a bunch of Eastern European bastards for human trafficking. I get yanked off that and put on this." Ballard realized where she recognized him from. He was on the video that had followed the report on the dancer shooting, on the newscast she had watched in the station on Friday. She was just about to ask a question about the case when a waitress came over and asked if Ballard wanted something to drink. She ordered an iced tea. When offered a menu, she said she wasn't eating, and the waitress ran away. "You sure?" Carr asked. "I ordered the fish tacos." "I'm not hungry," Ballard said. "Well, I've been running all day and need the fuel. Besides, you told me to get them." "This isn't a date, Carr. Get to your questions. What do you want?" Carr raised his hands in surrender again, and Ballard noted it as a habit. "I want to know about the last interaction between you and Chastain," he said. "But first, I need background. You two are former partners, correct?" "Correct," Ballard said. Carr waited for more, but soon realized that Ballard was not going to give more than one-word answers, unless he found a way to change that. "How long did you two work together?" he asked. "Almost 5 years," Ballard said. "And that ended 26 months ago." "That's right. You're the one who beefed Olivas, aren't you?" Once again, the blue pipeline had betrayed Ballard. What had transpired between Olivas and Ballard was a personnel matter that was supposed to be confidential. But just as the Blue Suitors and Hollywood Division roll call knew the story, so obviously did the detectives in Major Crimes. "What's that have to do with this?" Ballard asked. "Probably nothing," Carr said. "But you're a detective. You know it's good to know all the facts. The word I got is that when Chastain came to see you at Hollywood Station early Friday morning, things got tense." "And that's based on what? He filed a report?" "It's based on a conversation he had afterward with a third party." "Let me guess. Olivas." "I can't discuss that. But never mind what Chastain said. How would you characterize the meeting at Hollywood Division?"
"I wouldn't even characterize it as a meeting. He came to pick up a witness who had come in and I had interviewed. His name is Alexander Spates. He took a photo on his phone that captured the exact moment of the first shot at the dancers. Kenny came to collect both."
"Kenny?"
"Yeah, we were partners once, remember? I called him Kenny. We were very familiar with each other, but we didn't fuck, if that was going to be your next question."
"It wasn't."
"Well, good for you."
"What was the confrontation about?"
"His quote to a third party afterwards was, 'She's still pretty mad about things.'"
Ballard shook her head, annoyed. She could feel anger boiling up. She instinctively looked over the railing next to the table and down at her dog. Lola was lying on the concrete, tongue out, watching the procession of people going by on the boardwalk. The crowd was filtering out and off the beach post-sunset. Lola had been through a lot before Ballard had rescued her. Abuse, starvation, fear. But she persevered and always maintained her calm, until there was a legitimate threat to herself or her owner. Ballard composed herself. Am I okay discussing personnel matters, since you believe they are somehow significant to your investigation? She asked.
I think yes.